What's up, Sean?
What's up, Andy? I'm here. I'm queer, so deal with it.
All right, this sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good.
You're queer.
That's like
coming out of the closet.
Finally. Jesus Christ. My beard's in the other room. I guess you want to tell her? I'm a little delirious, I will say. It's a cold one out there today, isn't it, buddy? Did you ever see the guy Bear Grylls?
No, it's one of your gay friends?
No. I wish. I would befriend him. No, he's like, he's Australian. I think he's Australian, and he's like an adventure type guy. He's like Steve Irwin, but he always deals with extreme circumstances. He's like, oh, it's so cold out right now, blah, blah, blah. I feel like Bear Grylls, like a queer Bear Grylls. I'm here, I'm queer, I'm Bear Grylls.
So he's a guy who just goes out in the cold and complains about it.
All the time, yeah. He, like, walks through the frozen tundra, and he's like, oh, it's so cold. And he'd be like, the last thing you'd want to do is fall into a giant crevasse. And then he falls into a giant crevasse. And then, like, I'm surprised you've never seen this.
You should try hibernating. Wow. All right, so we're going to do a news episode today.
Yeah.
And the first thing I want to talk about, since we've been doing a lot of movie episodes recently, we both love the cinema. And you have been on the record that you feel like we're in a golden age of cinema.
I did say that. I'm not sure I believe it.
You're backing off on that.
Yeah. No, no. I don't know anything about movies. So, yeah, why not? Believe me. Believe me when I say a golden age of cinema. A lot of people are afraid that the golden age is ending, though, with this merger between, what, Netflix and Warner Brothers.
Right. So, yeah, Netflix made an offer to buy Warner Brothers that Warner Brothers accepted for $84 billion cash.
Nice.
And just today, Paramount upped that deal to over $100 billion.
Oh, my God. Cha-ching.
Which is actually, that was their initial offer, but it includes more than what Netflix was asking. I think they also want the WB, the cable network, as well.
Yeah.
And I think they're making a play for CNN. And this is all going to end up in the, what would be the DOJ, the FEC, FCC? The
FTC.
Maybe the FTC. Yeah. I'm not sure. This is going to have to go through the regulatory apparatus. So it's going to be Trump's decision.
It's going to cause a commotion like a DOG. It's going to be a big deal, a big payday if you're a Warner brother. Pretty good if you're a Warner sister even. It's going to make like basically one big streaming channel, right? As I understand. Why don't they all just combine into one big thing and call it cable? And then you could just download the cable app and you pay them like $100 a month and everything.
There's been some talk about that, but it was supposed to be like, you know, you pay for one thing, but you still have, there's still different companies behind it. Now, you know, we're approaching these mergers under like just a couple major companies, and
I would like to
the only antitrust now is only if you're woke, basically.
Right. Okay.
So that's the only hurdle, it seems.
Well, maybe I'm just woke enough. Maybe I believe in DEI enough that I'm calling for the singularity. I think we should just move into the point where culture is just a gray goo, where we can go into the hive mind. You were telling me about pluribus. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the Borg or something like that. We should just allow Elon Musk to put the Neuralink in all of us. And then we download the cable app into our brains and just all become gray goo. Who needs gray matter when you can have gray goo? That's what I say.
Well, there is some concern in the film industry, especially amongst the, you know, the various unions, SAG-AFTRA and the Teamsters, and the workers of the film industry are not happy about this because it seems pretty likely that this is going to cut production costs dramatically. Netflix has always been very interested in doing less. You know, Warner Brothers, of course, is this historic studio from the age of studios and lots and sets and, you know, film and such.
Right.
And Netflix is very much of the digital era, and it's their CEO, Ted Sarandos, has said stuff about how movie theaters are going away, and that's all right.
I heard, at least I heard from my beard, i.e. my wife, Rex King, that one of the fears is that because Netflix, obviously its core business model is the black box that is its like home streaming service, that it's going to put less resources into like theatrical releases, and theatrical releases are going to be shorter, so they can get them up on Netflix quicker. which I think for my purposes and your purposes, as people who really enjoy the cinema, that would be a real shame. So I'm not sure that I'm on board with all this consolidation and concentration of cultural capital.
It's not good, but it has been in the works for a long time. And I thought maybe it'd be fun to just give a brief history. So the Warner Brothers were some actual guys. It wasn't just the cartoon characters. They're actual four humans. They were Polish immigrants.
Warners.
The Warner Brothers. They were four Warners. They got their start showing movies to coal miners in Pennsylvania. In 1904, 1905.
Like they would just show up to the coal mine and be like, I got a movie.
Yeah, I got a movie for you. They branched out and had some movie houses and they started investing in production. They go over to Hollywood and they had their first hit film, which was a movie about World War I. And they were never one of the big production houses at the time, but they grew until 1924 when Goldman Sachs gave them their first major loan.
The Goldman Sachs? Golden Sachs?
Is Goldman Sachs a person?
I don't know.
If it is, that's who it was.
I didn't know that investment bank had been around for that long.
In 1924, they gave them their first loan. They start experimenting with radio in 1925, so they branch out from film to other forms of medium. Their first big hits were Rin Tin Tin and Lubitsch.
Rin Tin Tin, now that's a name that rings out through the ages.
Yeah, it rings a bell.
And the rest is history.
Hold on, I'm going through my notes here.
You got to get to the point where the Animaniacs appears. On the
so, page. Yeah, they were a pioneer. So they really made their name as a pioneer of the talkies with synchronized sounds.
Nice.
And their first hit was The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson.
Nice.
Film that's little seen today, but it was very important at the time.
Did they technologically innovate the talkies, or was this like an outside innovation that they licensed?
They were one of the innovators of synchronized sound.
Okay.
But it wasn't very popular at the time. But The Jazz Singer was a huge hit. They start a music publishing business. And in 1932, their big hits are musicals, but musicals are declining in popularity in favor of gangster films. Became known as a gangster studio with G. Robinson, James Cagney. And then in the 40s, they take over Merry Melodies and start doing Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig and stuff like that. In the post-war years, they run afoul with the Screen Actors Guild, even though they're making a lot of money. And they start denouncing their workers to Congress as communists.
Nice. Well, I mean, they probably were.
But then shortly after that, they get hit with an antitrust case, and that they have to break up their studio a bit.
Because of woke.
Yep, because of the woke New Deal administration.
The woke mind virus.
They were hit again in the 1950s due to the rise of television. And then this is the really important part of the story. In the 70s, they start moving more towards the kind of films that we might associate more with Warner Brothers today, like Blazing Saddles, Clockwork Orange, The Exorcist, and most importantly, they acquire DC Comics.
Oh no.
So they start having shows of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and The Flash, and this becomes like they're really for the film and TV wing, this becomes their big cash cow. And this continues into the 90s when they launched the WB. Remember the WB?
Yeah, okay, I forget, sure.
Which also has some, Smallville and like other superhero kind of programming oriented towards younger viewers.
Yeah.
They merged with Turner in the 90s and Time Warner. And so, the consolidation continues to grow up until the 2010s when they have two really big hits around then. One is the Harry Potter series.
Oh, that was them.
Which was a huge hit, although they apparently fucked up their financialization of it, so they didn't make any money. But they did make a lot of money off Batman.
Oh, when the Batman rebooted
the Nolan Batman, the dark noir Batman series.
So almost a return to form for them, because they sounds to me from this history you're giving that they were into nice family musicals, and they were into the talkies, and then they went dark and they went with James Cagney, shoot 'em ups. And it was a return to form when they were able to get to the Marvel movies and the Dark Knight and all this stuff. really, the Warner Brothers want to be dark-sided. They do not want to move towards the light. They want.
Yeah, there's that interesting tension there. And this all leads up to something that happened last year that I was trying to raise alarm bells of on the show. You can go back about a year ago with our Fight Club episodes.
Check it,
including an episode about Joker 2.
Oh,
so
Dance of Two.
Yeah, A Folie à Deux, yeah, or whatever.
I tried to watch that last week.
Yeah, everybody hated it. I liked it.
I kind of liked what I saw of it, but it didn't hold my attention.
Yeah, importantly, you know, Warner Brothers has this history of the comic book stuff, the noir stuff, floating them. Joker 2 was supposed to be their huge hit of the year. Oh. They spent a lot of money on it. Mm. No one saw it.
No.
Everyone who saw it didn't like it. Only John Waters and I saw it, and this was a huge catastrophe for Warner Brothers. Films in general last year did not do very well. But this one really, really hurt, and a year later, as a result of the twisted Joker, Warner Brothers is no more. They are now
kaput.
Yes.
Well, as a going concern, are they gonna, is there a sense that whoever ends up buying them, because there's Netflix and now Paramount, are they going to keep the label alive, like the name of the thing alive?
Unclear.
Wow, because remember HBO Max, that whole debacle, they took away the HBO part, and then they like quickly brought it back.
Right.
I feel like, I wonder if nowadays Warner Brothers is enough of a brand name that they would keep it just to have around. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. We'll find out.
Oh, man. Wow, what a twisted story that is.
Yeah,
man.
Everybody go back and watch Joker 2, the film that killed cinema in the United States.
It might be an inflection point for, like, people are calling, saying that it could be the death of Hollywood. I always feel like these things are a bit overblown, but I understand that Netflix is a whole different type of beast. You know, this is a new type of company on like a new type of medium, and could be kind of tough out there, folks. Could be tough. What else do we got? We've got some world historic changes happening right now in the world, my friend.
Speaking of the Joker, Donald Trump is up to his old tricks. Maybe we can talk about the national security document that they released this weekend that some are calling a school shooter manifesto.
There is so much gnashing of teeth and rending of garments. It is a kind of Joker-fied document. I feel like this is maybe the sequel to the sequel. This might be the third Joker film, and we're watching it in real time. What did you hear about this thing?
Well, I read most of it, and I read the articles that you sent from the Times.
Yeah.
I mean, the main takeaways that they highlight in those articles are very disturbing. Like, it's essentially calling for regime change in Europe, that, you know, basically saying we're going to, like, interfere in the elections as much as possible to put AFD and the National Front and parties like that in power.
They say national patriotic parties, right?
Right.
Yeah. We're used to doing that shit, but just not in Europe, right? That's like I think one of the headline fears is, oh, yeah, you know, this is the sort of thing in Latin America, you know, or Vietnam or Africa. These are things that the United States has obviously been doing to people, to nations all over the world for a long, long time now. But finally now, instead of having peer allies in the European Union, we're going to start treating them like we treat the rest of the world.
So in this document, they talk a lot about civilization, and it's pretty hard to argue that civilization means anything other in this document than white people. It's very clearly talking about the demographics of Europe, and the United States, and it is true that the United States will pretty soon be a majority-minority country. That's not true in Europe. Regardless, this is the really dark part of this document, claiming that basically the priorities in the U.S.-Europe relationship are centered around keeping a white majority in both places.
Right, yeah. The feeling I get from Europe right now is that they think that even the second round of Trumpism is kind of like a fever dream, and if they can just merely hold on for 3 years and one more month, then it'll all be over. And that, you know, and some of the things that they are pointed to in this document, demographic decline, which is, I guess, the flip side maybe of immigration, is very real. And maybe something the Europeans don't want to talk about, but, you know, in European countries, they're going to be losing like a million people per year from natural deaths and a lack of natural births. European countries, and depending on how developed they are, this is more or less true, are going to be going through like a severe demographic crisis, if only because the amount of working age people compared to the amount of pensioners is going to get real out of whack really quickly. So if you wanted to like be gracious about all this, which I'm not really super inclined to, you could say, oh, well, you know, the Trump administration is trying to, you know, move things in a direction that the European ruling class, as feckless as they are, refuse to do anything about. But what do you do when you're losing like a million people a year to like demographic decline? Obviously, it makes sense to bring in new people, you know, new immigrants, especially ones which has traditionally been the case, who are middle class from places like Africa and the Middle East, and who you don't actually have to like educate. They come here fully educated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hypothetically, at least on paper, a huge boom. But the fecklessness of this European ruling class, I think, can't be denied. And it's not merely a fever dream. And just because it's like the worst people in the world pointing out this, I think, pretty dire trajectory Europe is on, doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that obviously their solution, which is to tamper with European politics and put Alternative for Deutschland or help them get into power, is obviously not one that we would want to see. That said, you've followed the way that the Europeans have been dealing with Russo-Ukrainian war.
How so?
Oh, well, I don't know. There's a way in which the only thing really keeping the European Union afloat nowadays, as the whole project kind of came about in the 80s and 90s, so too has it now reverted into like a kind of warmongering clique, like a bureaucratic, technocratic sort of project whose only real claim now, especially as the U.S. Flees the scene militarily, is to stand as a bulwark against Russian aggression. Which is incredible, because they're making moves now, borrowing tens, hundreds of billions of dollars in order to rearm against a threat that the people of Europe don't seem to even really take seriously, but the ruling class does.
I think people in Europe take it pretty seriously.
They do. I mean, many of them do. Certainly many.
I think the majority of Europeans are in favor of defending Ukraine.
I think the majority of Europeans don't want to die themselves,
right,
in a war,
yeah,
in a nuclear war or a conventional war to defend Ukraine. And I think that what you've seen, and it's regrettable, it's terrible to see, but economically, powerhouses, especially Germany, which through our entire lives has been the real industrial powerhouse of Europe, is suffering deindustrialization on a scale that we haven't seen, I think, I don't know, maybe since like the, it's an inapt metaphor, but like since the Black Death, like an incredibly fast economic decline happening, if solely because the Russian hydrocarbons that they had relied on for cheap petrochemical industry inputs and cheap energy, plus they shut off their nuclear power plants like 10 years ago or so, means that Europe's economic decline is happening really rapidly. And at the same time as Germany's kind of opened its floodgates to new debt, which it's trying to use basically military rearmament in order to make up for the sort of like private capital, which is fleeing.
UK too, like their whole economy is basically arms manufacturing now.
Yeah, they're increasingly so. And so like the deal with the EU right now, and again, I'm not giving the Trump people undue credit here, because you could get this from Marxists, like Richard Wolff talks about this all the time, and other observers who are looking at the European demographics, European economy, and European politics. It's just an absolute fucking basket case right now. And so like all this talk of civilizational shit and like the West or whatever. I mean, obviously, like I don't. Not only do I not really believe in that, but I think it stands in for like what is a real issue that's not like a racial issue per se. It's just that, like, again, going back to the Black Death, like, when was the last time we've seen demographic reduction like this happen in a capitalist economy? The Black Death wasn't even a capitalist economy. Every economic indicator we've ever really studied and known over the last 200 years assumed an increasing birth rate. With Europe, it's decreasing rapidly and economically. So what I'm trying to say is that the EU is a basket case demographically, economically, socially. The migration that you've seen over the last 15 years or so really has torn at the heart of, you know, social cohesion in a lot of these countries, for better or for worse, and not helped by the nationalist politicians who are demagogues on this entire thing. And so, I don't know, it's hard to sympathize with the gnashing of teeth and the rending of garments of the European ruling class, while it's actually very easy to sympathize with the European people, whether they're natives or they're migrants to this continent, because things have been severely mismanaged there, both on a national and an international level. And the substitution of militarism for economic growth, or like the attempt to use militarization for economic growth, is a terrifying one, especially when you realize that Germany is at the heart of this entire thing. Like German rearmament, a return of German tanks to the Kursk salient. Like these are this is the stuff of nightmares in the 20th century.
Yeah, well, so this national security strategy document, basically the centerpiece of their policy proposal for Europe in terms of foreign policy is making peace with Russia. And they say this is a very important thing, both economically for Europe and then also just to avert a broader conflict, which is what Europeans are rightly correct about and why it's such a priority, both in terms of the ruling class in the EU, but also popularly, especially on countries that are closer to the front lines. They do not want Russia to feel emboldened to keep pushing into other places. And that's totally understandable. And so that part of the document actually, and the whole document, you know, I'll give it credit for being more coherent than Trump. You know,
it wasn't written by Trump. That's why it's
right. Theoretically, it was written or at least heavily influenced by Michael Anton, who's a guy who really emphasizes the civilizational aspect of it. But okay, if we're talking about civilization or Western civilization, you know, what does this really mean? Like, first of all, obviously the workers and other refugees coming into Europe and the United States are not uncivilized.
Right. So. No. You went to college, right?
Yeah, we went to college together.
So you remember, did they make you read a guy named Samuel Huntington?
No. I guess.
No, you never read that?
I was an undergrad. Maybe they don't teach that there.
I think I read it undergrad at like Hunter College in like a more advanced sort of thing. But it was very popular in the 1990s and 2000s. There was kind of Fukuyama on the one hand, like the end of history guy. You know, we're all familiar with him. Tons of great memes about him. And he's been proven right, as, you know, people like Varn would point out. But there's also a guy by the name of Samuel Huntington, who I believe has passed away for a long time now. But he was like a sociologist or a political theorist, I think out of Stanford University. And he surmised that after the end of the ideological struggle that was the Cold War, you would see a return to, not an end of history, but a return to struggles based on civilizations. Which he didn't necessarily mean racially, although I think you could definitely read that into it. What he meant was like a European sphere and then like a Muslim sphere, like a Hindu sphere, an Orthodox Christian sphere, like an African sphere. So it's this model that like after the end of the Cold War, you'd start to have civilizational struggles. And a lot of people saw 9/11 as a vindication of his theory. He is sort of
stupid.
Yeah, no, it's like a neocon theory, right? It has this sense in which like there has to be antagonism, and it's going to arise in places that like it was submerged during the period of the Cold War and then Pax Americana or whatever. So like, this is not a obscure theory, you know, but it is not a theory that you've seen in national security documents of the United States of America, and certainly not tying Samuel Huntington's ideas of like civilizational battles between like the Chinese and the Americans or Chinese and the Europeans or whatever with like the migration, let's call it a crisis, or you could call it issue, right? Which now has scrambled, I think, a lot of what Huntington talked about, but jives very well with like right-wing rhetoric about like an invasion of Europe, a great replacement, and like the civilizational struggle, I guess, in this case, is more of like an internal one as opposed to like external blocks based on civilizations fighting with one another, which is where it gets really dangerous, which is where it gets into Tommy Robinson territory.
What is European? Okay, so Europe is supposed to be this one civilization. I mean, I guess you could argue that there's kind of a northern European, like Germanic sphere, and then there's a southern, more Latin sphere, and an Anglosphere. But then, you know, these things are not separate from like an Arabic civilization or a Muslim civilization. Yeah.
You would say that.
Or a Slavic civilization.
Because you're a woke
commie. Because I'm a Jew?
No, because you're, well, I said you're a woke commie, so I guess so. No, yeah, you would say that. I would say that too. Like, I've never been like a Huntington guy. But like, there is a way in which it revives ancient and stupid, or not stupid, but like, let's call them atavistic conceptions of like Christendom versus like the Saracens, you know, or like Catholicism versus Eastern Orthodoxy. These sort of categories, like cultural categories or civilizational categories that we all, I think for good reason, because capitalism itself and like bourgeois society implies the overcoming of these categories and kind of all of us becoming juridical individuals and citizens and bearers of either capital or labor power or whatever it is. These things seem and feel antiquated to us, but it's this like attempt now coming from our executive branch of our government to try to like bring these conceptions back. As Huntington in the 1990s said, these are things that we need to start worrying about. Now it's coming from inside the house. And so there's no way, I think, that either of us as like woke commies, you're a Jew, I'm a Gentile, like we're not going to agree with this, but it has a long pedigree, I guess is what I'm saying. And it's fucked up to see.
Yeah. And so where I was sort of going with the peace with Russia thing, and as much as I want to see that succeed, you know, like the deal that Trump's trying to push through in the Ukraine, I think there's a lot of problems with it, but I, you know, as a sort of layman of the whole thing, I kind of hope it works, right? Yeah. But what's really scary about these things combined, like you can't isolate them from one or the other, is that this proposal jibes very well with the more national conservative populist positions of Putin and Orban. So it's not simply like we need to make peace with Russia. It's also sort of we have to accept the authoritarian right-wing conservative strongman mode of governance, and it has to, and we have to do this not only because we want peace and we want to you know, restructure the economy continue capital, you know, value accumulation on an international scale without war getting in the way of it, but also because we want to re-entrench the concept of nations and civilizations and races being essentially separate.
Yeah.
And so when these things are kind of combined together, it's not only an implication of like, well, this is a new mode for world peace. It's an implication of, well, we have to defend whiteness. We have to render certain regions of the world as, because there's a part in this document about Africa that's like, oh, the problem with Africa is that we've been spreading this liberal ideology there, and that's getting in the way of us just taking their resources.
Right.
And so the idea of making peace in Europe sounds great, but yeah, the combination of these things is implying this kind of like neo-fascist recolonial mindset, which is already like well underway in the way that Trump is just totally smashing through any concept of international or domestic law. So I think if we do want to talk about civilization in a serious way, or Western civilization in a serious way, like, what is Western civilization other than the, you know, what's proceeded from the Enlightenment and the concept of, well, if you're a French colonial subject from Africa, you are French and you can move here and be French. And if you're a migrant here, then we welcome you and you are welcome to learn our ways and we will learn your ways. And so there, diversity is a part of this concept of Enlightenment. This, because there's an egalitarian presupposition to it, and that's being thrown out, and that's barbaric. That is not civilized or enlightened. That is a, obviously it's a path to greater kinds of war,
conflict.
Maybe they can align the declining white populations for war against the rest of the world.
I doubt it.
This is kind of what Hitler wanted to do, right?
So Hitler wasn't, he was trying to organize like middle class and like intellectual folks and like shopkeepers and clerks, and then maybe like some sacks of potatoes. But good luck trying to like organize like a can of Pringles into battle.
Well, he also
like,
organized the bourgeoisie on the promise of the mass amounts of loot that could be had through neocolonial.
I guess my point is like, if there is any saving grace in all of this, it's that like it feels like bourgeois society has broken down in such a way. Civil society, let's say, has broken down in such a way that like when Germany just a couple days ago passed like a conscription light law that says if you're between 18 and 26, I think, and you're a male in Germany, you have to like volunteer to give your information to the government. And if they don't get enough volunteers, they're going to start conscripting people. Massive protests. And like among the youth, the people who would be the young Germans who would be fighting in this war, absolutely reject this conception that they need to be conscripted. So if there's any saving grace, it's that like capitalism in this particular stage has destroyed civil society in such a way that people couldn't even imagine sacrificing for anything like bigger than themselves anymore. So maybe they won't go marching off to like World War III or whatever. But I take all that you say like pretty well. And I think that trying to parse out the positive aspects of the Enlightenment versus like the shittier parts of it, because like Nazism and fascism comes after the Enlightenment, obviously, and its reaction to the Enlightenment within Western civilization. But it's also in a way part of it. It has like a rationality. It has like a mass politics to it. It has this idea that you're like taking ideas and like putting them into reality and like forging society and the nation state in such a way. So it's a maybe a fool's errand to try to disentangle good and bad parts of the Enlightenment, except as like a political project. These Trump and Orban and every Maloney, presumably all these people, they're trying to isolate, as you said, the parts of modernity that they like, which is like nationalism, which is a traditional culture. You know, these things are all very modern, right? And they're trying to utilize them. And we, I think, should hold on to these values of equality, liberty, and fraternity, right? The question is, under what conditions can that be possible? Because I don't want to sound glib, and I'm not glib about this shit. I see what's happening in Europe now, and I don't celebrate it, and I don't like certainly this rising tide of xenophobia, chauvinism, nationalism in Europe. And I think it's really dangerous. I think it's something that, it's not a flash in the pan. It's something that we're going to be confronting for decades. However, unfortunately, I see, not an excuse, but I see the reasons for why it's happening right now. And if you're going to have capitalism and you're going to have capitalist politics, you're going to have this kind of seesaw effect between left and right, between like a conservative liberalism or a reactionary liberalism and like a progressive liberalism. And we've lived 80 years with the right end of that spectrum for very good reasons being anathema to Europeans, and everything trying to keep that capitalist politics at bay, and now it's no longer possible. Which is not to say that we excuse it, but this is like, unless we create a different type of politics that's not a capitalist politics, that doesn't just oscillate between like Charles Schwab's or what's Klaus Schwab's like WEF, you will own nothing and be happy, sort of like progressive woke liberalism on the one hand, or the absolutely like psychotic, like Viktor Orban birth rates, like destroy the liberal university, destroy the media, fucking try to make more white babies stuff. If we don't want to keep oscillating between these two sorts of things, we need to have a sort of mass workers movement, a mass like union movement and political movement that offers a politics that breaks out of this entire thing. And the EU doesn't do that. You know, all this sort of bland technocratic, anti-democratic, like arresting people in Britain for tweets, or like allowing the US and Ukraine presumably to blow up the Nord Stream pipeline if you're Germany, or like whatever. None of these things are going to save Europe or Western civilization, as they call it, from what's coming down the pipe, which is not an issue of politics. It's an issue of capitalism. This demographic decline, you can acknowledge that it exists, that like there's not enough quote unquote white babies or whatever, and that immigration is a quote unquote problem. If you recognize it as a symptom of capital accumulation, we had Jason Smith on the show to talk about development and birth rates, right? This is not something that's exclusive to even white civilization. It's something that's happening in South Korea. It's something that's happening in Japan. It's something that's happening in the United States. It's something that's happening in Colombia. You know, it is a trend in capitalist development. And if left to like the most feckless, craven, opportunistic, mercenary, and corrupt ruling class, maybe in European history, if left to them, they're going to leave a giant fucking wide open vacuum for Alternative for Deutschland and maybe something much worse to fucking walk right through that door, because their only solution to this issue is to ignore the sort of social and economic and political ramifications of their own actions. And Russia, you know, I want peace too, is a great distraction. It's a real thing, but it's a great way to kind of turn all of the social divisions, class divisions, economic divisions happening inside of the European Union and push them out externally to an external enemy. And I follow this stuff. I watch and listen and read about it every single day. And I think that it's a much greater threat to world peace, what's happening with people like Kala Kallas in the Baltics, Ursula von der Leyen, Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank, Merz in Germany, and Starmer in Britain. I think they're a much greater threat to Western civilization, as it were, than Putin or Orban could ever be at this point, if only because they're in power and they're showing their fucking asses, but they're trying to like sweep all this stuff under the rug, and it's going to come to light anyways.
Well, I think you made a very good point that there's this shifting back and forth between Klaus Schwab and Orban and, you know, right populism, left populism, that sort of thing. And I think the challenge is to recognize that it's the same thing. We're talking about different styles of technocratic governance. They're interested in birth rates because it's a question of the labor market, right?
Right.
They're interested in culture because they serve different factions of the national bourgeoisie, or want to project stability for capital accumulation in their country through different uses of state power.
They want to gain legitimacy among, right, like the burgermeisters, like the middle classes of their country, in order to like use cultural nationalism. But yeah, go
and
on.
And on the flip side of it, the strategy of bringing in a lot of immigrants as a proletarianized, precarious reserve army of labor is a lot different than any sort of enlightened conception of welcoming people or some sort of egalitarian diversity, right?
Yeah.
It's another technocratic solution that does create problems, because if you bring in a lot of people who are impoverished and ghettoized, then of course there's not going to be a smooth, you know, and I don't know how serious these issues really are in the UK. I know, like, the fact that there's pogroms going on there, or like being organized there, and throughout Europe are responding to, you know, the fake stories of no-go zones and grooming gangs and stuff like
which
that.
Which we've been hearing for years, and right. It's why when both Max Shanley came on the show and then, what's the guy's name?
Ralph Leonard
came on the show. I asked both of them, you know, one white and one black, I asked them if things were really that bad, and they were both like, well, not really, no. Because this sort of sensationalization of, like, the no-go zones, remember that was a fucking joke 10 years ago when people first started talking about it, it'd be like some right-wing influencer would be like, this is an Islamic no-go zone, and they'd show, like, a no-drinking sign or whatever, and it turns out that this is just, like, the party district in London, and it's no drinking because, like, kids are always out in the street drinking. There is a way in which social media is amplifying all this stuff, and it's really, really hard to understand what's going on. But when you see the pogroms happening, you realize that people are opportunistically, they're demagoguing about this, and they're opportunistically using this as an excuse to, like, terrify working class people, migrants, and others. And absolutely, you can give no quarter to that, no quarter whatsoever, full stop, at the same time while saying that Keir Starmer is a fucking a terrible leader and B, like, a fucking like a ruling class twat that needs to be
Keir Starmer's no friend of the immigrant population either,
right. But if these are our choices, right, if we are either given Tommy Robinson or Keir Starmer, then of course you would go with Keir Starmer. But, like, what I would argue, and I think you would agree with me on this, and if you're a listener of the show, you probably agree, that, like, we need a third thing. Like, there has to be another option besides lining up, like, with a Labor Party or with the Christian Democratic Union or with Macron's party in France as an attempt to, like, forestall these forces that have been on the rise irrespective of which technocrat is in power.
So, you know, getting back to, like, the hyperbolic rhetoric about immigrants and refugees, you know, it's not so far from home because we did have a huge influx of asylum seekers to New York in the last few years, like during the middle of Biden's administration. This is another article that you sent me, the Times kind of going through just how it was that Biden's border policy came to be. And it seemed to be a combination of, like, he comes into power, he wants to reject Trump's hard border policy.
I think he saw it as his mandate, right? He saw that as, like,
and it was,
family,
you know,
separation and all the stuff at the airports and the, what was it, banning people from certain countries. I think there was, like, a rightful revulsion, you know, during Trump's 4 years that when Biden's elected, he says, like, well, this is part of what I was elected for, which he was.
Right. So he tries to do a more humane border policy. You know, obviously there's still, ICE still exists. There's still lots of arrests and deportations and that sort of thing. But he comes into power at a point when there's already a surge of immigration and asylum seekers coming to the southern border because the pandemic and other factors have really made life in Central and South America unlivable for millions of people. So they start coming in towards the end of Trump's term. It surges during Biden's term. There's the Title 42, which, like, closed the border for pandemic reasons.
Right.
And Biden keeps that until a certain point when, like, the pandemic is over in his view. So that opens up the ability for more people to seek asylum. And what was really interesting about this article is that according to Biden officials, you know, take that with a grain of salt, this is what they're telling the Times.
5 years later, but yeah.
Yeah. They said that the Biden administration recognized that this was a problem of basically too many people coming in too quickly. Oh, he also rescinded the stay in Mexico policy. Mm-hmm. So more people were seeking asylum and going through their case within the United States. And he thought this could cause a problem, but it would only be for the border states.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the border states start doing is they start busing people to DC and New York and other blue cities. And this was, in this narrative, incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And there was an interesting...
Greg Abbott in Texas starts it, yeah.
And this is something that we definitely saw in New York, where these buses start arriving. Adams comes and welcomes them and says, this is what New York's all about. We love immigrants. Right. Come on in.
Yeah.
Within a year or two, he's
like, this is going to destroy our city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's treating these people like scumbags and criminals. There's, like, the media is slandering them left and right. You know, I know a lot of these people have part of mutual aid groups that shifted tremendous amounts of resources and energy towards welcoming these people and getting to know them and trying to make sure they have some base level of dignity because the city was absolutely not providing it for them. And this was, I think, the major failure of the Biden administration within this narrative of the article, because they proposed, instead of Abbott sending these people to New York as a propaganda method, how about we have ICE send them where they want to go or where we can provide them resources, right. So they're not all crowded in southern Texas, for example, where there's not enough work and there's not enough shelter. And Biden rejected this because he thought that that would be illegal, or maybe he just thought it would look bad.
It would be too high profile. It would look like what it would be, which is the federal government actually helping people. Somehow would be like, instead of doing that plan and saying like, yes, this is what we're doing, because it rationalizes what's otherwise a chaotic process. And because these people like are trying to go to places for family, or they're trying to go there for work or whatever. And if we don't do this in like a subsidized, like governmental way, it's just going to happen chaotically. And stood by that. If they just stood by that and said, this is our policy, it would have been one thing. But instead, they were mealy mouth and they were cowards, essentially. So the Biden administration cowered it out when it came to the optics, right, of this whole thing. And it seems to me like this article blames the left wing of the Democratic Party a lot for the pressure that it put on the Biden administration.
Well, it blames the Biden administration for being too sensitive to the demands of the left wing.
Right.
But then on the flip side, it, you know, like not like just having people stay in southern Texas was not a left wing proposal. So it kind of, I think the main blame, if this narrative is to be believed, is that Biden just didn't have any coherent policy for this. And I think this is true. I mean, I saw this a bit when I briefly lived in Germany around 2013. And so this was when a lot of Syrian refugees were coming in. Right. And it was a similar story there. Like there was this welcome culture, but then people came in and they had to wait a really long time to try to get a work permit, which would allow them to have some decent standard of living, but the government made it really, really difficult to get those permits. So people just kind of had to, like, you know, live in the streets or hang out in the park or sell drugs or just do whatever they could to get by. And so this was a part of, like, that neurosis of, like, oh, there's Arab and black men everywhere now, and, like, we can sort of... Yeah. That sort of becomes like an aestheticized version of deeper anxieties about the future of their country or their lives.
And then in that analogy, I think it's a really apt one, because of course, like, the United States, along with its helpers in the West, civilizational West, destroy Syria, right? That's where these millions of refugees come from. And then Merkel, I mean, I guess you'd say to her credit, she's a monster, like all of them, but she says, like, we can do this. It's her famous line. In German, we can do this. And she's saying that as a political comment, saying like German society can take upon these million refugees. But where the analogy is apt is that Greg Abbott is the governor of Texas who sends all the refugees up to Washington, D.C. and really politicizes this. It's Viktor Orban, if I recall correctly, who ends up, remember, he puts that big giant chain link fence between him and I guess would be Romania or Bulgaria or whatever. I guess as a practical measure, but more as a way to politicize this entire thing. And then similar to, you know, Europe, we here saw like a snowballing, like you said, Mayor Adams, you know, and a million others realizing that this was a political liability, not just the chaos of it, but also the fact that the opponents of any migration whatsoever, the racists out there, let's call it what they are, the white nationalists, the ethno-nationalists who are now part of, unfortunately, the political debate in this country could make a lot of hay out of it. So it was like cowardice, but it was like political cowardice too, on top of everything else. It was like an inability to actually stand up and own this, you know, to own this.
Yeah, policy. And that goes on all sides too, because a lot of the asylum seekers were from Venezuela, and they start taking this insane, dangerous journey to the United States because Trump opened up a lot of slots for Venezuelan refugees, and a lot of those refugees were largely produced by the U.S. blockade on Venezuela, right? So there's the same thing with this new offensive against asylum seekers now from from Somalia, from Afghanistan, you know, revoking visas and canceling, you know, even people who have earned their citizenship, their ceremonies are being canceled now. And, you know, this all got started because this child soldier of the CIA who was groomed into a death squad in Afghanistan was cut off by his handlers in the last several months. Like, at the end of the rope, he shoots a couple National Guardsmen. And so Trump produced this. You know, Trump, the United States in general produced it, but cowardice to not recognize the root causes of these things. The New York Times doesn't do it either. They don't really look at exactly why millions of people are coming to the United States.
No, it's like incredibly absent from this article. You know, absent also from this article too is the fact that this deals with the end of the first Trump term, the pretty much entirety of the Biden term, and then obviously we're living through the second Trump term. But it's like this all comes from like the absolute failure of the legislative branch, which is the one that's supposed to be doing all this stuff, to like come up with some sort of bipartisan consensus. And we've talked about this on the show before. Turns out that bipartisan consensus has been made impossible because you're pulling at sort of conservative impulses within the middle classes and the working classes. You're dealing with labor market issues. You're dealing with the needs of capital, big, small, medium capital. And this Gordian knot, let's call it, of an issue has proven to be like insurmountable. And in fact, if our republic does die, and it feels like our republic is dying, Donald Trump, of course, being most to blame, but you could blame Biden for that as well, and the Democrats and Republicans, capitalist politicians in general, right? This will be at the heart of the reason why. It's because it's an extraordinary crisis that has come about because the ordinary political workings of the American Republic have proven impossible for at least 40 or 50 years, right? The refugee law that a lot of people have started to use as the conditions in Central and South America, and to a lesser extent, Africa and Asia and elsewhere, have gotten dramatically worse since COVID and before COVID. The refugee law was passed under Ronald Reagan in 1980. The human right to move and migrate in Europe, it was passed around the same time, before the ravages of climate change, before this like downturn since 2008, before like this kind of growing chaos has started to envelop the globe. The refugee thing was seen as like a good bourgeois internationalist rejoinder to the failures of the world and the nation states of the world in the 1930s and 40s to save the Jewish people of Europe from destruction, who were trying to flee and could find no refuge there. Well, that's a situation, and we have a different situation now, one that's way different from 1980, where not just the United States imperialism, not just the legacies of colonialism, not just climate change, but like economic depression that we've been in since 2008 has really ravaged the Remember when they used to talk about like the rising tide lifting all boats? Remember when there was a sense that like liberal internationalism or globalization or whatever, globalism, as the right would call it, was a developmental scheme that places like Venezuela, Colombia, places in Africa were supposed to get better. They were supposed to industrialize, that like they were going to be part of this greater process of raising people out of poverty. Only China has done that. That's like the only success story in this entire thing. So lost in this entire article too is the failures of capitalism to like include at least half of the globe in like a prosperous and fair developmental process that might make capitalism actually worth it, because enough of these profits and value being created gets passed down to like working class people throughout the globe in Central South America and elsewhere. That's just completely stricken from the record, as though that never existed. You and me grew up in a world where that was the idea. You know, remember the 90s? That was the whole fucking idea. Nobody even talks about that now. Even the August New York Times, even the Biden administration, it's all about managing the chaos that comes from this shit.
Yeah, I would say that that Trump document, the NSS, also bears the birth pangs of that neoliberal logic. You know, that stuff is still there. There's still like stuff in there that's a holdover from the Biden world order as much as it's a break and in certain racist ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, you said we need to have a third thing. And so I included this article in our show notes from EndNotes, who just relaunched their sites. Yeah. And this is one of their new essays that they put up called Angels and Demons by a writer named HB. And it's a very, there's a lot going on here. I'm really like worried about trying to summarize it, but it takes the position that what's going on in the Trump administration now is a counter-revolution against 2020, against the George Floyd uprising, against the general instability, social, political, economic of that time. And so it goes through a lot of different things. It goes through the way Trump targets MS-13, another Latino gangs, and Columbia University for left-wing radical ideology, and then Antifa as well. There has to be these boogeyman that allows for the expansion of extra-legal executive power to like overcome the limits of the legislature, like you said, of democracy, in order to take this more full authoritarian strongman position, because the, you know, what we're seeing generally is the, from the left wing of capital, from the right wing of capital, a delegitimization that like saps their authority to do anything.
Right.
And so in the absence of authority, he's arguing that they resort to pure state force. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Trump represents, is the consolidation of state force within the executive branch as a guarantor of resumption of capitalist accumulation and maintaining these sort of nostalgic ideas of sovereignty, like a, you know, a white middle class dream of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. In a situation where not only is that sort of challenged by this this stagnation, this decline since 2008, but also a wide-scale popular disinterest in the state as a project. Mm. The patriotism that, in effect, hates America and the American tradition and the Constitution, yeah. Right? It ends, you know, with a position that I'm not sure I really agree with, but it gets back to our civilizational discussion. Let me read a bit of this.
Yeah, go for it.
Latino culture has massive hegemonic power in Southern California, not necessarily at an institutional or political level, but an ethical level. The sheer scale of the mobilizations against ICE in Los Angeles demonstrates that a huge portion of the city's residents are willing to fight to defend a form of life that has been declared and in large part is illegal. Then there's the fact that migrant labor in Los Angeles provides many of the only affordable options for everyday necessities like food, childcare, and of course, manual labor. Insofar as there is no oppositional political party in the U.S., mm-hmm. protest movements are more likely to identify with ethnic and racial minorities than with any political position. That's why the last three nationwide uprisings in the U.S. have taken place in defense of Black, Palestinian, and Latino populations. The myth of the so-called white genocide underway is, of course, a lie. But like every effective lie, it points to something real. This is what you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. As they did during the George Floyd rebellion, large parts of America's white population are disavowing their culture, their heritage, their politicians, entire ways of life, and siding with undocumented immigrants. Meanwhile, 21-year-old Mormon furries are making high-profile assassinations of major America First figures.
True.
There's only one Mormon furry. But
yeah, you know. Just one, but that we know of.
Of course, this is an incredibly contradictory process with many confused motivations, yet still it is incontestable that some kind of war for or against whiteness is underway in America in a highly pointed fashion. And I'll jump to the end here. Today, the system of nation states once led by the United States finds itself reeling. As international politics become more turbulent, new waves of nationalism are emerging in a desperate bid to stabilize the pandemonium unleashed by the collapsing international order. Capitalism's uneven development is fueling volatile ethnic tensions, as seen in the UK and Spain, where rising immigration, economic insecurity, and media-driven moral panics around Muslim mm-hmm. and South Asian communities have produced fertile ground for far-right movements. These conflicts reveal the contradictions of capitalist expansion can no longer be contained by rhetoric or institutions of liberal multiculturalism and will have to be confronted politically. The nation state can no longer evade the problems of international politics. Any politics oriented around the nation state are today either reactionary or obsolete. And then he goes into a little bit about this concept of the Latin Empire, which is a term from Kojève. If we're seeing the kind of collapse of the American Republic in some sense, then we might see some sort of Balkanization. And, you know, Southern California is, you know, historically a Latin territory.
Yeah.
And so today, the fact that in California, as many people speak Spanish as they speak English, is in the eyes of Trump, that's a bad thing. In our eyes, we don't care. You know, we defend people who are workers and living the way of life that they choose to live, because we're not technocrats and we're not trying to solve demographic questions. We're humanists in a Marxist sense, and that's obviously very different than humanism in the technocratic sense, right? Or in the Klaus Schwab sense, or,
right?
You know. So yeah, read that article. It's really interesting. It's in the show notes.
I would say this about all of that. There are two great republics in North America. There is one nation that never attained sapience, which I guess is Canada. You know, they're still a Commonwealth country, so they still have, I guess they have King Charles now, right? But the other great republic with its own revolutionary tradition, of course, is Mexico. Or, as we never call it, but we could call it, the United States of Mexico, which is mm-hmm. its official name. And I don't see any reason why it couldn't have 50 more states. You know what I mean? Like, all this talk, like, what was it that, like, Chris Crutrone, like, was all provocative and was telling people, like, we should take over Canada? No. Mexico, much, very interesting revolutionary history. We should cede ourselves, like, turn back the clock to 1848 and cede ourselves to Mexico, because they're sure doing a lot better industrially and politically right now than we are. I'm being, like, ironic about this entire thing, but I really feel like what that article's saying, like the obsolescence of the nation state in the face of globalized supply chains and global capitalism, and a global, more increasingly a global proletariat, right, in on the move, is making the idea of a border between Mexico and the United States, which goods, commodities pass, people pass through, capital passes through all the time, making it redundant and increasingly politically absurd. You know, mm-hmm. like the existence, I will agree that the existence of Canada is absurd, right? Canadians out there, your whole existence, I find it absurd, although Tim Hortons, the coffee is totally fine. And then maple donuts are actually really good, right?
I hear actually they changed the recipes for those, and they're not good anymore. I'm not sure the last time you had it, but...
Sorry, Canada.
The Canadians are not happy about what Tim Hortons has done.
I will say that we should allow Quebec as one of the new states within the United States of Mexico, but that's about it. Like, we need to think about these things in ways that are different. As Andy quite rightfully said, different from the kind of either left or right technocrat that exists in our brains, because we're all kind of raised to understand politics as like crisis management or in this like pendulum that swings back and forth. And you need to vote for Trump to stick it to Biden. You need to vote for Biden to stick it to Trump or whatever. Unless we break out of this, it's going to continue to be migration on top of other issues like the economy for working class people in this country, working class people all over the world. The movements of capital, the movements of currency, inflation, deflation, factories moving in, factories moving out, farms being small, farms being big, farms getting small again. These are all forces of nature that feel like the weather, you know? They're like things that happen to us. The economy happens to us. The commodities dance and we stay in place, and we're constantly buffeted by these forces that we have no control over. Maybe every 2, 4, 6 years we vote for somebody who's going to claim that they have some sort of solution to this. And maybe they put a solution in place that lasts for a year or a generation or whatever. But then we're back to where we were before, and a new crisis arises and society is forced to confront that. And we put another one of these fucking jokers in. Like, we have to understand migration and migration politics as standard capitalist technocracy and standard capitalist politics, right? The people that are in charge in the United States, whether it's Biden or Trump, there needs to be a certain amount of migrants here. They need to be either highly exploited or just a little bit exploited. They need to be highly oppressed or just some of the way oppressed, right? But if we continue to let this imperial system that we have, this technocratic system we have here in the United States and the EU, this political duopoly that exists right now in this country, if we just continue to acquiesce to that and accept that as the only form of politics that's possible, like the weather, like when a hurricane comes, we're going to be bowled over. When the pogroms begin, it's going to be like, I don't know, a king tide combined with a storm surge and you get a Hurricane Sandy. We don't have any control over this shit as capitalist subjects. The only way we can imagine that we can garner some control over this as capitalist subjects is to organize ourselves not on the basis of capitalist politics, not on the basis of national politics, because we see that that's a dead end, right? We don't do pogroms. We don't do any of that shit. We don't even do pogroms on the capitalist class. What we do is instead, like a fighting force, like a giant army, we organize ourselves into a mass movement, pre-political movement that can make politics on a different plane possible for the first time in maybe 111 years. For the first time, have a politics that actually can meet the moment, have a political party of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, that might make these crises, which are constantly coming up, might show a different way out of them that doesn't involve us having to pit ourselves against migrants, migrants against other people, whites against blacks, Latinos against Chinese, whatever the case may be. I know I just mixed up categories there, right? But that's the point, is that we're going to continue to drag ourselves into this fucking abyss, especially as economic, political, and climate conditions get worse, until we actually, unlike Biden, get the fucking cojones together to make a fucking stand and say, fuck all this shit. We need our own thing. We need to build our own thing, our own institutions, our own mass movement, our own political parties, our own revolutionary unions, our own everything, so that we can put this fucking system to bed, because we don't want to be buffeted for the rest of our lives like a fucking ship without a sail, just buffeted by the winds and the storms. We want to actually have control over our lives. And that's what a proletarian socialism argues for.
Yeah. Of course, I agree with all that. I would just add to this, and I think this is something that this EndNotes article does pretty well, is saying that, yeah, so a lot of these mass struggles that we've seen in the EndNotes decade didn't have the political coherence that you're calling for here, right? But at the same time, it's not like the struggles today are merely on the grounds of capitalism or like defending the current wage relation. It's about defending your neighbors and your family and your friends. And you want to talk about defending the traditional characters of your country or of your city or whatever. Well, what better example of that than the people rioting against ICE, about the people running ICE out of Chicago, running ICE out of Chinatown in New York? So these movements are here. It's not a explicitly mass working class party oriented thing, but these are our ideas, and we have to bring them to these struggles to make it happen. You know, just having these ideas and calling for it doesn't make it happen. We have to be there on the ground.
Absolutely.
And I'll just close this free part of the episode. I think we'll do a little bonus where we talk about death by lightning.
Death by lightning. Talk about buffeted by a storm. If you're James Garfield,
talking about President Garfield, who was killed by lightning. I want to close this episode by saying that we lost another great thinker of these exact questions that we're talking about communist revolution, the working class, who they are, what they think, you know, how they organize, and also questions of identity. We lost Assad Haider last week. He was on this show in 2020. He was someone I've met several times over the years and a really important and inspirational person for me. Maybe I'll tell a little story about him on the other side of the paywall.
Yeah, do that.
But I'm going to close this episode with a chunk of that interview from 2020, and the link to the full episode is in the show notes. So enjoy that, and rest in peace, Assad. And
rest in peace.
Condolences to all of our friends who are really close with him. I'm very sorry for what everyone's going through, and we're all going to miss him.
Yeah, rest in peace, man. And thanks to everyone for listening. Check this interview with Assad Haider out.
Let's say, first of all, that the underlying premise of any egalitarian politics is that everybody has an equal capacity for thought. I mean, this is fundamental, because if people can govern themselves, we have to recognize this capacity for thought that everyone has, and that everyone has in different ways. And we have to recognize that, you know, the kind of, it's a classical political philosophical discussion of who is fit to govern a society. That's the underlying question of politics that everybody asks. And so I was referring earlier to categories like tyranny and despotism. Many political philosophers thought that democracy would be the despotism of the majority. You know, you have all of these stupid people who are not fit to say what happens in a society, who suddenly get to have a choice. And, you know, you have to prevent that by any means possible. But the defense of democracy that some people made in response was that, look, many people together, when they think together and add their thoughts and capacity for thought to each other, are able to have greater knowledge than one person alone. One person may be highly educated, may have read a lot of books, etc., but that person will never be able to achieve the kind of knowledge that they can by joining their thought to others. And that's the basis for an egalitarian and genuinely democratic politics.
Yeah, so I think that kind of connects with the next thing I was going to bring up about the Vanguard Party and the function of the party. We should say that what Marxists mean by the party is different from the colloquial understanding of it as a political party like the Democrats that mainly runs candidates for office. It's a kind of organizational body that I would say theorizes in an exchange with movements on the ground and helps to focus and coalesce the politics of whatever dual power organs have arisen, which might not necessarily be politically coherent on their own. The classic example is the Soviets in Russia. Like, what should be, like, do we need a party or party-like organ to serve that function? Or should we rely more on these sort of grassroots, rather decentralized groupings, like Soviets or whatever you want to call them, to do the work of governance themselves?
Well, you know, of course, the slogan "All power to the Soviets" is Lenin's slogan, and he is also the person to whom the idea of the Vanguard Party is attributed. And actually, you see historically this great problem that declaring all power to the Soviets and declaring the need for smashing the existing state meant that there was a kind of gap left, like, what's going to happen in between the smashing of the state and the reorganization of society around the direct democracy of the Soviets? It's really not clear. And so what happens is that the party fills that gap in the Russian Revolution. The party becomes the state. And so, and then the Soviets are subordinated to the party state. And that's, that model is finished. We can no longer see any emancipatory potential in that model. However, we also can go back and ask, what question was the party answering? Because we can't accept the idea that the Vanguard Party is just a kind of blueprint for how organizations should be that is invariant and applies across time to every situation. There was a really specific, and if, look, you know, it's supposed to come from Lenin's "What is to be done." You read "What is to be done." What were you saying before? Shit posting. I mean, like, it's you have to know the names of 12 different Russian journals that he's criticizing before you even get to any of his own points. I mean, I read about people who said, "I read What is to be done, and then I realized that I had to whatever." It's like, how did you read this? It was like impenetrable. But of course, we know now, this wasn't a secret, but it's been emphasized in scholarship recently, that the idea of the party, or the model of the party that Lenin is advocating and What is to be done, was derived 100% from the German Social Democratic Party and from Karl Kautsky and so on. The idea that there had to be the introduction of socialist consciousness to the working class from the outside, from intellectuals and so on, that was an idea of the German Social Democratic Party. That was the orthodoxy that everyone believed in. Rosa Luxemburg believed in it, everybody else. And so what was Lenin doing? What was he doing that was distinctive in what is to be done? I think the most interesting answer comes from this guy, Sylvain Lazarus. I wrote a piece about him based on his work called Socialist Think. He says Lenin's idea was that politics only happens under conditions. Straightforward way of putting it, but it means something very significant in my view, which is that politics isn't just always happening. It's true that people are constantly engaged. Workers are constantly engaged in struggles to better their immediate conditions and so on. But that doesn't mean that the idea of a transformation of society, of an emancipatory politics, is actually being put into action. That's something that has to have separate conditions, that has to be positively, deliberately, and affirmatively brought about. And I think that Lenin's idea of the party was there has to be some material force, there has to be some organization that brings about the conditions for emancipatory politics to happen. Now, if we were to reduce that to the structure of the party that the Bolsheviks had or whatever, that would be a serious mistake. I think we need to take this insight that politics happens under conditions and then use that to understand the whole wide range of actual organizational forms and practices that would be appropriate for our own situations to bring about emancipatory politics.
These questions?
If I'm a little distracted today, it's because I'm working on History as a Weapon number 7, which will be coming out soon. And the premise of it is going to be this, I think this truth claim that was put out that history is a disaster and history is a failure. And I think that without getting completely doomer and blackpilled about it, I think that it might be time now in this kind of interceding moment between the kind of the collapse of the Bernie electoral campaign and hopefully the rise of something else for all of us to make a clear accounting for ourselves and for the movement of what has gone wrong, but also the deep historical structures and tendencies that have brought us to this moment. Because it's simpler than simply, it's not as simple, I should say, as Democrats versus Republicans. It's not as simple as saying neoliberalism, as though that's some sort of shibboleth. You throw that word out and all of a sudden the veil falls from people's eyes and we know exactly what we're trying to confront and why. I think that if anything right now, we should be taking a deep look. We should maybe be pulling back to the extent that we can without, you know, losing all of those organizational structures we created, and just start thinking very, very deeply about, the entire 200-year history of what we've tried to do and why we haven't got there.
Well, I would add, you know, I say history is a disaster. I don't believe in a kind of hope or optimism which says that things will turn out well, that we can predict on the basis of currently existing patterns that things will turn out well. But I think at the same time, we can look back at history and see that disaster has been interrupted and that human beings are capable of things that go completely beyond what appears to be possible.
That's right. And what seems to be natural today, the modes of life that we have in this moment, are not natural by any stretch of the imagination if you look at the broad sweep and geography of human history.
Of course, and also, you know, this is part of why we can't just dismiss the legacy of the 20th century revolutions, because they're examples of circumstances in which, you know what, like three people went out to the countryside and organized a peasant army and overthrew imperialism. That's a level of human achievement that is hard for us to even imagine now. And I mean, who, the people who did it, like, you know, intellectuals, can you imagine our favorite socialist friends in the media going and living in the jungle and building a radio station and just building a peasant army and storming the cities. I mean, you know, people have achieved this, and people have engaged in enormous human sacrifice in the name of the possibility of human emancipation. That has happened. And, you know, we have a choice. We can say either, well, things are bad. We can try to just adjust to the reality that we have. Or we can say that the fact that people lived and died for this before me means that I have to, in some sense, continue that. I have to take that up. I have to take up the idea that emancipation is worth fighting.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap it up with a shitpost question.
Hell yeah. Give it to us.
Wherein I ask, is Noam Chomsky a liberal?
That's seriously the question you want to ask me?
Oh, you passed the test.
If you reject the premise of the question, that means you're correct.